Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I could have lived without that line. The episode would have lived without that line. But I knew that if I lost that, the next silly battle would be easier to lose.
Television icon Norman Lear wrote sitcoms that tackled real issues like rape, abortion, and race relations. When the network wanted him to drop a potentially controversial line, he just said no. This Labor Day weekend, we revisit a conversation with Lear, now 93. He talks about a few lifetimes worth of adventures in film and television and his memoir, Even This I Get to Experience. But first on an all-new banter, a shakeup at Marvel and the Sony hack makes still more news. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Good afternoon.
So lots of news this week. Let's start with Sony. The Sony hack is a gift that keeps on giving to journalists, but not so much to the Sony studio. They have this movie Concussion coming out with Will Smith. They released a trailer this past week. To me, the trailer just looks like the movie might as well be called, Football Kills People. But yet, the Sony hack revealed that Sony had somehow tried to twist itself into a pretzel, making nice with the NFL while making this film about this researcher who found that, in fact, guess what? Concussions are really bad for you.
Yeah, Sony is walking another fine line here, which they did with two other fact-based dramas, The Social Network about Facebook and Zero Dark Thirty about the hunt for Osama bin Laden, in that they're trying to make a fact-based drama here while walking the line between entertainment and not causing legal problems. And there's a whole discussion, several discussions that go on in the emails that were hacked and revealed by the New York Times that shows that Sony really tried to reach out and appease the NFL and tone things down. We posted at The Hollywood Reporter a specific scene from the script about Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, that was cut from the script, in which he's told by doctors, Roger, this could be really bad. This could open us up to liability, all this other stuff. And, an effort was made by Sony to tone this film down.
Yeah, it just seems so oxymoronic to me. It's kind of, as I said, it's like the movie condemns football, and yet they're trying to. We'll see how the movie plays, but based on that trailer, I don't see how you get yourself there.
And the director has been very clear that this movie pulls no punches, and he believes this is a very critical assessment of the NFL's response to this problem.
Right, and any changes were made just to avoid potential lawsuits, defaming people like Roger Goodell, for example. So we will see how that plays out. Meanwhile, over at Marvel, a shakeup. Now, Marvel has been run by this 72-year-old man, Ike Perlmutter, an eccentric man, a very thrifty, obsessively thrifty man, a controlling man, a guy who carries around a gun a lot of the time, apparently. An unusual character, but a very big shareholder in the Disney company. He had been really in charge of the whole company, which is part of Disney, as I say. And Kevin Feige, who ran the film division, has for some time found it surprisingly frustrating to deal with this controlling man who would decree things like a journalist at a press event for the upcoming film could have one soda, but not two. This kind of detail, very important to save money that way. So Kevin.
Well, maybe he's just keeping a lookout for our health. That is nice
yes,
of him.
Yes, that is a valid concern. But Kevin Feige, apparently, somehow or another, probably by threatening to quit, has wrested himself free of Ike Perlmutter. And a lot of people have known about how cheap they are with talent, what kind of deals they make that are very, burdensome on even big names. They've sort of said, this is the money, take it or leave it, and it's not that much. Will be interesting to see now whether something changes when Kevin Feige no longer reports to Ike Perlmutter and his committee that he had that was really trying to run the show on these movies. And, as somebody pointed out in an article that we just put together, Ike Perlmutter has never made a film. So I'm probably frustrating. Kevin Feige's not a filmmaker either, but he certainly is basically a producer.
Well, he's overseeing the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which has grossed more than $7 billion and completely reinvented the superhero genre. So I think if anyone deserved to report to who he wants to report to, it's probably Kevin Feige. The thing that's interesting right now is they have a movie they're working on, Captain America Civil War, and that is being described as sort of Avengers light. It's not one of these standalone Marvel one-hero movies. It's got all the Avengers in it. It's a bigger budget. And Ike Perlmutter, we're told, was very budget conscious on this movie, did not want them to spend what Kevin Feige thought they needed to spend to make Civil War an interesting movie. And that's what caused Marvel's own internal civil war. That's what led to this whole problem, and that is why he is now no longer reporting to Perlmutter. He's reporting to Disney's Alan Horn, which runs the rest of the Disney film unit.
Yeah, or at least it was certainly, we were told, a catalyzing event. Now, maybe not the only event.
Sure.
It'll be interesting to see whether Kevin Feige gets at all over his skis a little bit with this, or whether, you know, or whether he really just is going to be running a tight ship. It's also interesting that TV is run separately out of New York. They have that, you know, some couple of series on television with Marvel characters, and none of which are as nearly as successful as the films, and how they'll sort of make all that work when there's been this rift will be something that people will watch, I think, pretty closely.
Definitely.
Meanwhile, DreamWorks. DreamWorks, as we also reported, is winding down a relationship with Disney. It hasn't been that super happy. It was made under Dick Cook, who was shortly thereafter, he was running the film studio at Disney. He said, you can participate in our movies, we'll help finance your movies. And then shortly after they made the deal, Dick Cook was gone, and the head of Disney, Bob Iger, said, we're actually not doing that kind of thing. That's not our theory anymore. We have Pixar, we have Marvel, we have all these divisions. We don't need to partner up with you or anybody at all, ever. So we're not going to. And DreamWorks really tried to come into existence at a time when the markets were terrible, and it was just a struggle. And they actually picked a lot of not good movies.
Well, they had some successes, notably the Spielberg-directed films like Lincoln. And I think they're probably going to have some hits with Bridge of Spies, which comes out this fall, and the BFG next summer. But beyond that, they had a string of problems, and they had to bring in their own money from this Indian company, Reliance. So DreamWorks doesn't really fit into the Disney mindset right now. Disney film division is all about tent poles. Marvel, Lucasfilm, Star Wars, Pixar, Disney Animation. These adult dramas that Spielberg likes to make and produce don't really fit in there. And honestly, he's a better fit at Universal anyways, where his office has been maintained even while they had the Disney deal and while they had the Paramount deal. So I think Spielberg going to Universal makes a lot more sense than keeping up at Disney, where it was never a good fit.
Yeah, so we'll see Steven Spielberg back at Universal, where he's always been, with some new financing and a reboot. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter.
From Television City in Hollywood.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made.
Those were the days.
When Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton invaded America's living rooms as the bigoted Archie Bunker and his sainted wife, Edith, television was changed forever. All in the Family, which ran on CBS during the tumultuous 1970s, dealt with gritty issues, smashing the mold of fluffy sitcoms like Petticoat Junction and Green Acres. It was TV's number one show for five consecutive seasons. With his partner, Bud Yorkin, our guest today, Norman Lear, produced that show and many others, including Maude, One Day at a Time, What's Happening, and The Jeffersons. Now Lear has written a memoir. Even this I get to experience. The book is a journey through Lear's life and a look at Hollywood history through the eyes of a legend who worked with legends, including Danny Thomas, Frank Sinatra, Mel Brooks, and Carl Reiner. When Lear joined us in the studio, we started out with a little reminiscing about the last time we met. You know, I was actually looking back at the piece I wrote about you for The Hollywood Reporter.
Yes.
When I asked Rob Reiner about you, he said you had balls the size of Montana. So I'm fact-checking.
Are we on the air?
Yeah, we're rolling.
Oh, and you're saying balls?
Saying balls on public radio air.
Well, for crying out loud. Well, he's right. And I mean, I walked in and I left them in the car.
Okay. So there's a lot of gambling in your story, right? And as you go through life, you're pretty gutsy about gambling.
Well, in business, I don't know. I guess you could call it gambling. I think of it more as conviction that is a gamble to others.
On a couple of occasions, and starting, I guess, with All in the Family, although maybe before, you wanted your cut, your version of the script, and you basically said, if you don't do it my way, I'm walking out of here. And you're saying it's a matter of conviction, not gambling.
Much more conviction. It turns out to be a gamble. Life is a gamble. You know, you get up every morning, you're gambling, you're going to be there tonight to sleep and wake up the next morning.
Right.
Also, it sounds like, as you describe it, I won big wars.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the way it felt. The way it felt at the time was the network was being silly, ridiculous, or some network executive reporting to an executive above him who was reporting to somebody above him who was reporting to somebody in New York.
Right.
That's the hierarchy and the way it worked. Was making a silly decision in the first episode of All in the Family when Archie comes in from church having left the sermon because he was pissed off at the reverend and the sermon itself. The kids having the house alone, Mike and Gloria, they have decided to make love, and they rush downstairs when they hear the door close. Archie knows what, you know, guesses what they were up to, and he says, 11:10 of a Sunday morning.
Right.
You're early.
So are you.
We're just going to go sit down over there.
Yeah, Beth. 11:10 of a Sunday morning.
They wanted that out. Why? Because it was specific. It pointed to the fact that they were going to make love.
Married couple.
Well, and that's what I said. Married couple. They were going to make love. 11:10, it had to come out. And I could have lived without that line. The episode would have lived without that line. But I knew that if I lost that, the next silly battle would be easier to lose, and the ones that followed from that. So I had to say there will be no show if you take that out.
But you have to mean it. If you say, I'm going to walk, you can't bluff.
Well, I did mean it. I did mean it.
When you did, you did All in the Family initially. I think you were doing it for ABC, and they kept balking.
Yes.
They were scared of it.
Yeah.
And they wanted you to redo it, and you left the script exactly the same.
The way the contract was written, they could cause me to do it again.
Right.
And that would allow them to hold it for a year, and they did that. And so I made it a second time for them. Different young people, same Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton were there from the beginning. And it's my good fortune that it took three times to do it, because by then I ran into Sally Struthers. I hadn't known of her before. And Rob Reiner was now old enough, I thought, to play the role.
And you knew him since he was a little boy.
I did.
Yeah, because he was obviously the son of Carl Reiner, and you were friends.
Yeah, we were great friends.
So you had the cast. You did it the same way every time. You didn't think, maybe I should make it a little different at all. You just, I like it this way. This is the way it's going to be.
Well, there was no story at all, really. It was their anniversary. The kids were doing a brunch for them. My kid picked up a little gift for them. That was the entire story. So that I could write 360 degrees, what I call the 360 degrees of Archie Bunker. You'd hear the kind of things he might say at any time. I used to say to the network, we got to get wet together. We jump into the pool and we get wet. You're never wetter than wet.
Right.
And this script was designed to do that. So that's why I stuck with it.
Of all the people you've worked with, I think you talk about Carol O'Connor as the most difficult, challenging every script.
Mm-hmm.
What is the cause of that, do you think? Just fear, pure fear?
I think it was a couple of things. I think certainly fear. You know, we were reaching 50 million people a week.
That's a lot of people.
And he was it.
Yeah.
And he was playing the role he was playing. So he didn't like a lot of the things he was asked to do. Not because he was he wouldn't say those things, but because he disagreed about the story. One of the halcyon moments was we did a show where he was in an elevator with four other people. The elevator got stuck, and one of the people in the elevator was a woman who was due to have a baby in 2 weeks. She panicked. The baby is born, and he thought, cramped in an elevator. There was no way to do a show. It was, the other relationships, everything was wrong. And then at the end, a baby was born. And I don't know. I can't explain it. He wouldn't do it. And I was too much in love with the notion of a camera on his face while the first sounds of a baby's life were heard.
Look at this!
Oh, Mr. Bunker, he's perfect!
Ain't it supposed to cry or nothing? That sounds kosher.
You know, after a lot of Sturm und Drang, we did the show, and it was glorious. And the first one to understand that it was wonderful was Carol O'Connor.
And did he ever come back and say, you were right?
No, but when he passed, and I went to the home to see Nancy, she asked me to wait till everybody had left. And when we were alone, she unlocked the door to his study. And his desk was clean, but for one piece of paper. It was a letter I'd written him 4 years before in which I told him how much I loved him and how grateful I was for him and how much I regretted we had these arguments all the time. And it was on that desk, she told me, every day all those years. And we loved each other and still fought.
Yeah, it's just one of those relationships, I guess. And yeah. A talent like that is frequently not an easy person, right?
Not an easy person. And, I wrote a character. He inhabited it. There'd be no Archie Bunker just because I wrote him.
Right, of course. He was perfect. He was perfect for that. So looking back to when you grew up, you describe very engagingly in the book this childhood you had, and your dad ended up going to prison because he basically was a guy who failed in a lot of businesses and was kind of a con. Right? Mm-hmm. And this was a painful thing. And I think you've said in interviews that confronting this in this book was something you weren't that thrilled about having to do.
Well, I wasn't thrilled, but I knew I had to do it. I couldn't write the story without writing the truth, and that was my truth. It also framed or bended my character, whatever my character is. It was shaped in those years.
What do you think the impact was?
The impact was I wanted to at once run as far from the character as I could and hold on to him for dear life because I loved him.
You know, I wonder a little bit going forward as you got into show business. You weren't above a little bit of a con yourself. You kind of conned your way into Danny Thomas's notice.
Conned, you would say?
Well,
I called him and told him I had something he could do quickly for the Friars Frolic the next day.
But did you not get his number by proposing as a New York Times reporter?
Oh, I did. Yeah, no. I called his agent's office at the noon hour, hoping the agent would be at lunch, and he was. And I said as quickly as I could, I said to his secretary, I'm Merle Robinson. That's the name I used.
Merle Robinson?
Because I love the name. I'm with the New York Times. I just spent a couple of days with Danny Thomas. I'm doing a story, and I'm at the airport now. I'm flying to New York. I'm going to write the story on the – and I have a couple of questions. Oh, they're calling my plane. She gave me his number.
Okay.
He was fascinated with how I got his number.
So that worked for you?
So
you confessed.
Said, well, that's a funny guy. Maybe – so he said, get over here right away with the material. I said, it couldn't get over for about 4 hours. He said – you said you were in Hollywood. I'm in Beverly Hills. But I hadn't written this thing yet.
So maybe you learned a little something that was useful at the knee of the old man, old father.
I learned you got to blow your own horn.
Coming up after a short break, Lear laments the current state of network television, but hasn't given up completely. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
The This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer and producer Norman Lear, the man behind TV shows like All in the Family, Maude, Good Times, and Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, among others. Lear's new memoir is called Even This I Get to Experience, and he's gotten to experience a lot. In addition to his decades of work in television, Lear is a longtime activist and advocate for progressive causes. He founded People for the American Way in 1981. 10 years earlier, when All in the Family started on CBS, Lear didn't see himself as someone sending a message. He was simply looking to entertain. But then his perspective started to shift.
We were accused of it in a harsh way. I mean, what I heard most of all was at the beginning, if you want to send a message, there's Western Union.
Right.
You don't use television to send a message. But a couple of years into it, I realized two things. One, we were serious people. I was a serious person. I collected serious people around me. We were writing about what we felt about the times, using the subjects that touched us as family members. And that reflected a point of view. I understood that. Then when I thought back to the shows that preceded us, the Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction and those shows, I realized they were presenting American families where the biggest problem might have been that the roast was ruined and the boss is coming to dinner. Or mother dented the car, how do we keep dad from finding out until she gets it fixed? Or,
yes, these little trivial things.
If that didn't send wall-to-wall, floor-to-ceiling messages, I don't know what did. I mean, there were no problems in the American family. You know, there was no rape, there was no illness, there was no economic problems. Everybody was having a glorious time unless the roast was ruined.
Right.
So I thought, well, that's a heavy message. America has no problems at all. And I thought what we were doing is light message-wise compared to that.
We had Neil Baer. I know you know a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, I know Neil Baer.
Okay,
I
think, you know a lot
of
people.
Neil Baer. Yeah.
So Neil Baer, who worked on ER for many years, was on the show recently,
right,
actually talking about his decision to come out as a gay person. And he said in those days, he could do things about really serious, you know, he had one of the first HIV-positive people
right.
on the air. He doesn't think you can do that on primetime anymore. He thinks there's been a kind of a reaction away from it. And I don't know how much TV you watch now. I know you watch certain shows,
yeah,
but I don't know that you're watching network.
I'm not watching a great deal. No.
And
I understand from people who are showrunners that, like I think you were going to say about Neil, they don't think All in the Family could exist today, wouldn't get on the air today. And the subject matters we touched on wouldn't work today. They just wouldn't allow it. So, and I imagine that's what Neil was saying.
Yes, that's what he was. It's a strange dual universe where you have this vibrant cable world with a show like Transparent, which you were a fan of, right? Amazon. It's not even on television. And at the same time, we have this kind of conservative broadcast network environment. Why would that be? I mean, the broadcast networks
are still the big tent.
We
are a culture that looks itself in the mirror and doesn't see itself honestly. And we've become a nation of consumers, and it's all about selling. It's not about being real. It's not about reflecting truth. It's all about selling.
Your show, I mean, in the day, the shows on the networks reached more than 120 million people a week. That's an enormous, it's so different now. So when you look at the revolution in this business where you can't reach millions of people on the scale that you did, but you can do a show like Transparent on Amazon, is it better now or is it worse?
You know, I'd have settled all those years ago for a law or a rule that made television available 12 hours a day and not 24 hours and 24/7. And it's too much. I don't know what should be done about it, but, you know, walk into a restaurant and see a family of five, three people on their cell phones.
It's awful, yeah.
And some of them watching something. You know, kids in a family not talking and relating, but watching a show or playing a game or whatever. It would be all right if we talked about it and wondered out loud where we're heading, what we're doing. We might change attitudes. We might see things differently. But we're confined to bumper sticker conversations, you know, and people yelling at each other. That's right. How we get the news. No context.
Right. Very reductive kind of news sometimes. Excuse for news, I should say.
Yes.
So you've seen these revolutions. You went from radio to the birth of television, the VCR, all of that. I don't know. Do you come away? Do you say, okay, there's this internet and it's invaded our lives to the point where it's disrupting the dinner table. Do you feel discouraged by that? Or do you think we learn how to handle this thing, this digital monster?
I'm concerned with real problems and where they could end up. Climate change, I think, is very real.
Yeah.
I worry about that. But I don't want to wake up any morning I'm without hope, so I won't.
You decline.
I'm hopeful. I don't know how we get through, but we'll get through. And given how many planets there are, a billion among in universes of which there may be a billion, how do we know how many other peoples like us vanished over the centuries?
Right.
You know, how far they came and how quickly in nature's timeline they vanished.
And let me just, at the end of your book, you write, as I report on myself in these pages, what surprises and pleases me most is the consistency in my life. What does that mean?
It means I've always basically, you know, there was a hurricane when I was 11 years old and living with my grandparents, and I was at Woodmont, Connecticut on the beach for the summer, and everybody lost their clothespins. And I went into New Haven with two
pillows. I feel like I can see this coming, yeah.
With two pillowcases, and there was a clothespin factory, and I filled up and it sold clothespins, three for a dime or a nickel or whatever the hell it was. So, you know, that dogged personality or persistence or whatever, that's been consistent. Fairness. When I learned at age 9, listening to Father Coughlin, that people hated me or at least disliked me or didn't mind because I was Jewish, despite a First Amendment and a Bill of Rights and guarantees for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that's been a steady in my life. So when I realized that black people had it far worse than others, and other minorities and disabled and so forth. Just basic, you know, I can't say fairness without saying American. Basic American fairness. And where it doesn't exist, as it didn't, I thought, when the evangelicals began to proliferate on television, didn't seem fair at all to me. And those are the through lines in my life, a number of those, and that's what I mean. I'm proud of that consistency.
You're commonly referred to as an icon. How weird is that?
That's weird. That is truly weird.
Norman Lear is a writer, director, advocate, and a force behind TV shows like All in the Family, Sanford and Son, One Day at a Time, The Jeffersons, Good Times, and Maude. His memoir, Even This I Get to Experience, is available now. Thank you for coming in.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.